Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to The Main Course on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I am Alexis McLaughlin, here as always with Philip Gilmore.
Good morning.
Very excited. We have Katrina Birchmeyer in studio.
Hi.
Katrina is the front woman of new but already acclaimed Williamsburg wine bar, Four Horsemen. So thank you so much for coming in and chatting with us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We got a lot going on. Right now, it's fall. It's been kind of busy. I know I've got everything going on with Goat-tober. I don't know if you guys have heard, but the month of October has been changed to Goat-tober, where we celebrate goat as a seasonal meat.
We were slaying it with the goat this weekend at Moku Moku.
I heard you give a really good explanation, Goat-tober, at Moku Moku to that couple that came in.
Yeah.
You were explaining why.
I kind of just like everything in my life, I just kind of wing it. And so I've come up with this concept of why Heritage is promoting goat is because there's been so many, you know, like really innovative ways to, you know, basically raise animals in the last 15 or 20 years. And everybody knows about heritage pork and Wagyu beef and corn-fed versus grass-fed and all this stuff. And, you know, everybody forgot about the little goat farmers. And so I think that just as like the pork that you had 20 years ago or the beef that you had 20 years ago is now better in America if you know what you're eating, so too is the goat completely. The goat game has changed. So yeah, we were doing goat chops, which amazing. They're just these little chops, but and then also we were doing goat curry, like Japanese curry, and it's just like everybody that had it was just like, oh my god, you know.
I love the goat buns and the goat gyoza you guys do.
Oh yeah.
And then do you know the original dish we did was the goat offal.
Oh,
awful.
Yeah?
I don't know how. Awful.
I always say awful.
Yeah, I love awful. But we were we were sitting around and we had this whole goat and we were in a new restaurant and we're like, what if, you know, there's just this pile of, you know, basically garbage. Yes. And and we're trying to, and I always wanted to do some sort of in my fantasies, I always wanted to do some sort of like Japanese haggis. And I'm like, here's my chance. And so, you know, the original one was basically, we did like, what's it, Faras al Hanout, the Moroccan lamb spice, dates, garlic, rosemary, and then just all the parts, and then made handmade gyozas. And the first time we did that, we just like sold out of them in like 2 days. So, yeah.
Phil is a huge awful fan.
Yes.
He lives for it. Is you're from Australia.
Yeah.
Is there a culture of eating awful in the cuisine there?
I mean, people do. I wouldn't say there's a culture of it. It's definitely for the more adventurous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what about people, like kind of like indigenous people or poor people that half
kangaroo hearts.
Yeah. Like if, you know, like 100 years ago in Australia, if somebody kills a whole animal, do they utilize every part of it to eat or?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I haven't read the history books on it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the kangaroo pretty much is a rodent, and we eat that.
Yeah.
We kill them and eat them.
Like, is there anybody doing, like, force feeding kangaroos and making, you know,
like avocado fed kangaroo?
Like hoppity hoppity foie gras.
Not yet, but that sounds like a good idea.
I just There's said hoppity hoppity. I don't know what that means, but it shows
the noise the kangaroo makes when it jumps.
Yeah. Yeah. It moves all the fat around inside the liver, so it's extra fatty. Yes.
I've actually had kangaroo before.
Any thoughts?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. It was a thing that I ate. I don't really have strong memories of
it. No, I didn't have strong feelings for it or memories of it.
No.
I think I had like a kangaroo like tenderloin once at like one of those like kind of like, you know, like one of those places that do all exotic meats, and then I've also had kangaroo jerky before.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can find kangaroo jerky pretty available.
There was this restaurant in Sydney and they do all these pizzas. They have like emu pizza, crocodile pizza, kangaroo pizza.
Yeah, the face that you're making, if only our listeners could see behind the scenes. Not a fan.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I guess, people eat crocodile down there, I guess, yeah.
Not really. Really? Just that place.
Well, you're talking
just
to,
for marketing.
If I'm not mistaken, Alexis might know of a restaurant in South Florida called RJ Gators.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's actually a chain restaurant, and it's basically like a, you know, like just South Florida trashy, almost like TGI Fridays or Applebee's. But then they have like two or three things on the menu that are actually alligator.
Gator steak?
Yeah, basically.
Gator's not good.
Yeah.
I mean, it tastes like what it eats. It's kind of just fishy.
This is completely off topic, but a little on topic.
Nothing's off topic.
No, okay, fine.
What is the topic?
Good question.
Rare animals. So I was listening to 1010 Winds Stuck in Traffic, and they announced that I guess it was Thursday, was rare animal pet amnesty day in Long Island. So
what?
if you have an illegal pet, you set up a couple of these centers, and you, no matter what the animal is, no matter how illegal it is, you can bring it and you won't get arrested.
Wow.
Why do you bring it there? Like for...
Oh, man, there's so many reasons. I mean, do you know about the, like, lionfish? Lionfish?
I know that they're bad and they're invasive.
I know
But you know how it happened? It's actually kind of the plot line for Deuce Bigelow. You know, that whole, like you know, basically the story is that the conspiracy theory is all these Colombian drug dealers in Miami all had these huge, like, $2 million fish tanks, and they would buy lionfish, which is like this really rare, you know, fish. And then the lionfish would eat all the other fish. And so they always lived like right on the bay. And then these guys would, like, it happened so many times that people would just throw lionfish into the ocean that two found each other. And now it's a complete epidemic in all of like Gulf of Mexico and Bahamas. And they're eating all the fish.
Know.
So actually, if you're a spear fisherman and it's your duty, like
if
to
you
kill,
see a lionfish,
yeah, you
kill
have
them.
To kill it. So,
wow.
Yeah. And then also too, there's like anacondas and like boa constrictors in the Everglades now. And they're like, you know, 30 feet long. And so it's all about like two of these released animals finding each other and then breeding. And it's happening all the, you know, yeah.
Everglades. The people, they go on like these crazy hunts for the anacondas down there.
Yeah.
Like they'll just, you know, the entire communities like pitchforks and pillowcases.
Oh, and then also, guns. I didn't even remember. And then also, too, rich kids in Bushwick, they're multiplying.
Yes. The next invasive species.
16 years ago, there was no rich white people here. And look, and then they just cut two of them, found each other, and just started multiplying. Yeah. And there I am feeding them sushi. Yes, don't feed them after midnight. They're like little gremlins, you know. You feed them once, and then.
Are you worried right now that you're alienating your customer base?
No. Yeah, so, yeah. Sometimes, you know, we'll, there's always rumors for like ever that, you know, there's going to be a new hotel here or there, and people are like, you know, oh, yeah, that's going to suck. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I know, it's going to be so sad. All these, you know, all these people are going to come eat at my restaurant. I'm going to be so
all these new customers.
Yeah, boo hoo hoo. Yeah. So tell us about your childhood.
Childhood.
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty boring. No, I had a great childhood actually.
Yes.
Thank you.
Did you have any exotic pets?
I never, you know, my first pet was two goldfish. That was all I was allowed to have because my parents feared I would, you know, have a puppy, get obsessed with it for like 6 weeks and then be done with it.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And that's what happened with the goldfish.
Really?
What were their names?
Steggles and Stumbles.
Steggles and Stumbles.
They
I don't know
how long did they last.
I ended up giving them away. They had a pretty good life, but they were neglected at some point.
They could have done the inverse, which is bought you like a little baby Tasmanian devil, and then it would only take one time for it to bite your finger, and you're like, I don't ever want a pet again.
Yeah. No, they bought the very calm goldfish. That was all I was allowed.
Not the
feral. So not exotic. No, yeah. No.
So you came to New York to help open Four Horsemen,
yes.
Which is really interesting. If you guys haven't heard, really interesting wine bar. They've got a pretty, you know, advanced wine list, like with, you know, focusing and featuring natural wines.
Yeah.
they found you somehow. You were in Tasmania. You had your own restaurant that you'd opened. Garagiste. And that had a pretty interesting wine program, too, based around natural wines.
Well, this is not the story of my childhood, but this, my professional life story. No, so I opened Garagiste in 2010. And to set the scene, Hobart is the capital of the state of Tasmania, which is a tiny island off the bottom of Australia. So it's pretty isolated. So, you know, there is a small kind of wine industry in Tasmania, and, you know, to bring in natural wines and all these wines, crazy wines from around the world, was a little bit unusual. And, it was a pretty kind of quiet place that hadn't seen a lot of action. So we started this restaurant with pretty innovative and interesting food, like focused on a lot of local ingredients, and had growers, you know, growing heirloom vegetables and such for us.
Was the food scene down there? Were other people doing interesting things? Or
they are now,
seasonal,
but
local?
We did sort of pioneer that, like, that industry. Oh, that sounds a bit pretentious, but we did, you know, we did sort of kick something off where, you know, there's a lot of young people doing interesting things there now in the food scene. And natural wine had kind of, you know, there were a couple of importers who were starting out, like, maybe, I don't know, 2007-08, they were starting to import those kind of wines, and then we kind of were one of the first places to really focus on that as a restaurant in Australia, all the way down in Tasmania. So we were pushing boundaries, and, you know, we took a great liking to natural wines. We just found that they had an interesting story, interesting flavor profiles.
Can you define a little bit natural wine? Because it's something
that
I've heard.
And also what natural wine?
Yeah,
but it's not something that I'm... know the definition, like what makes a wine considered natural wine?
I mean, there's different... I mean, it's a term that, you know, brings up a lot of arguments, I guess. It's not necessarily a totally official term, but the way I look at it is wines that are made from grapes that are grown, you know, chemical-free, so either organic or biodynamics, not necessarily certified. In the winemaking process, there'll be no additives. There are actually a lot of additives in more commercially produced wines. So no additives except for maybe a little bit of sulfur dioxide as a preservative at bottling. And the wines are made with the grape's natural yeast, so not adding a commercial yeast that really controls the fermentation and also controls the flavor profile of a wine. So these wines can go crazy because they're let to do their own thing with their own yeast. So that's kind of how I look at natural wines. They're also very small production, so often difficult to get your hands on.
When did we start putting a bunch of additives in wine? Like, when did wine... Because I'm assuming that back in the day, when wine was around, it was all natural wine.
Yeah.
When did we get away from...
I don't know exactly when it was, but, you know, I guess it's like anything with the growing of food, and when farming became more of an industry, and not just when it grew,
the commercialization,
I guess, and people, you know, wine became a product that was marketed, and it had to fit a certain, you know, profile year after year after year. People want consistency, and I guess with natural wines, you get like something different every year. It is an expression of the place, the weather, the winemaker. Every year it's different, and it's not manipulated to change that, to bring it back to a certain thing. It's basically what happened that year in a bottle.
Are there certain varietals that lend themselves better to natural production, or do you see any repetitive, or is it really run the gamut?
Yeah, everywhere. Any varietals. I mean, a lot of producers are bringing back kind of indigenous or forgotten varieties in their regions. I guess a lot of the larger commercial wineries may have come into certain regions and started planting certain grapes that might grow better and yield better. There are, I guess you'd call them farmers, but the winemakers that are bringing back forgotten varieties, I guess, like same with, you know, the heritage foods that you work with. Yeah.
Awesome. You were talking about, as far as the food goes, using local ingredients. Like, obviously, there's a lot of fish down there, I'm assuming. But yeah. But also, too, like, maybe talk about a little bit about the fish that might be different that only Tasmania has. And then are there any, like, fruits or vegetables mm-hmm. or animals that you're serving that might, you know, obviously that would differ from New York and the United yeah. States, but is there anything specific to just Tasmania that separates itself from, like, New Zealand and Australia?
I mean, Tasmania has, you know, cold, very clean waters, so a lot of good fresh seafood, amazing oysters, like, I've never tasted any so good, so creamy. I guess, you know, I'm sure there's certain species of fish that are different, like the striped trumpeter, which is kind of like a, I don't know, a bit like a cod, I guess, in a way. I don't know. Probably got that wrong, but...
we're not counting points.
So seafood was definitely a focus. I mean, there's a lot of the seafood actually in Tasmania would get exported to Japan, mm-hmm. to Hong Kong and things like that. We had a very good eel farmer who we worked with, so we used to get live eels.
They're so fun to work with, right?
They are crazy. There was this one time because we would get them live and we'd butcher them. They basically, the chefs would slit their, or chop their heads off, I think, even, yeah. and let them bleed out in an ice bath and in the walk-in cool room. And then, you know, it'd be like 8, 10, 12 hours. And then somehow one of the eels that had had its throat slit was out of the container that had a lid on it on the floor in the middle of the walk-in. Yeah. So they kind of go crazy for a fair while after you
can
hit
actually,
them.
You can actually, the first time I ever worked with eels, I was completely out of my element. And I actually got, I'm like, I'm going to make live eels. And I was doing it by myself. And I was like, oh, it's just, I'm going to let it just kill it. And then I killed it and then still moving. And then I chopped it into pieces. And then it was still moving. And then I said, okay, well, I'm going to make a marinade. And then it was really freaking me out, like almost like haunted. So I put up a marinade of, like, you know, sesame oil, garlic and ginger and soy sauce, blah, blah, blah. And then I was like, I was so freaked out that I just put it in the freezer. I'm like, this is going to kill it. And I came back 30 minutes later, and I swear to God, I thawed it, and then it started moving again.
Their nervous system. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, jeez, they're kind of crazy. Yeah, so we had fun with that. We had an amazing grower. She's still doing her thing, but she would grow lots of heirloom vegetables and, like, Australian native herbs and things like that. So we got a lot of interesting stuff from her. We were very close to farms, so it was, like, pretty amazing what we could get our hands on.
The climate is pretty cold there?
It's pretty cold. I mean, it's...
It's not New York winter
cold. It's not New York winter cold. I'm scarred from New York winter, can I just say? But, yeah, it's a cool, you know, relatively cool climate, but it's... We're able to grow a lot. We were able to grow a lot of different things there, like even some kind of, you know... Asian herbs that might grow in more tropical climes, but yeah, it's there's lots of little different microclimates as well. So,
is that mountainous?
There's some kind of smallish mountains.
Yeah,
some craggy hills.
Craggy hills.
Were you able to find natural wines in Tasmania that were being produced in Tasmania or Australia that? You hadn't found before? I mean, I'm familiar with Kim Crawford, but...
Well, we had... There was one winemaker, Dirk Muir, who became a very good friend of ours, and he had a very, very small vineyard, 1 hectare, and he was making wines naturally, basically, and he unfortunately has since sold his vineyard because he's a little bit too old to make wine anymore. Doing it as a one-man show, but his wines were pretty amazing. There's a lot of people now moving towards biodynamics down in Tasmania, but in Australia in general, there's a lot of fun stuff happening in South Australia, in the Adelaide Hills, and stuff in Victoria as well. There's a few producers that bring their wines over here. James Erskine from Jalma Wines. Who else is there? There's Anton van Klopper from... Lucy Margot. So, yeah, you'd see a few here, but, you know, it's tiny production, so, yeah.
Actually, when I first started Momo, we actually served, we only had one white and one red by the glass, but I think it's called Yellow and Blue. Do you know this winery?
I do not.
It comes. Yeah, it's great. It actually comes in a 1 liter box.
Oh.
But it's like, they switched owners, and it was hard to get, so we couldn't get it anymore. But it was for the price. It was great wine. It was biodynamic.
Yeah,
it was biodynamic and natural and all that stuff, and it couldn't have been better.
And they do it in the box because it's like more environmentally sound than all the bottles and.
Well, you know the what kind of sold me on the box wine was like, you know, they were saying, listen, if you're doing some like, you know, some amazing Bordeaux wine and you're going to wait 20 years to drink it, by all means, put it in a bottle, put a cork made out of cork. That's fine. But for something that is going to be put on the shelf and bought and drink immediately, the fact that it's coming from Australia, it's like so wasteful for it to be, because the glass is, you know,
heavy.
The glass is heavy and the cork is made out of cork. And then even if you do the plastic, you know, thing, that times a million is a million of those things that doesn't need to be in it. It's going to taste exactly the same if you had a cork and put it in glass.
And if you're doing it by the... In a box, it's vacuum sealed in the case.
Yeah, it tastes exactly the same. You know.
Can someone define for our listeners who may not know what biodynamic is? Not me, because I don't know.
Well,
it's just fireworks, man.
Yeah,
it's
an extension, I guess, of organics in the sense that it's also dealing with or looking at things like the. You know, the moon cycles and like, yeah, it's
with an emphasis also, I think, on the like clean water is one of the things.
And also, I guess it's about,
does it describe more the farming system? It kind of sounds
it's kind of like that. And also like, you know, what do you say? Like not preventative, but like just building healthy, you know, a healthy environment for growing and
without all the chemicals and
without all the chemicals. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot more in depth than that, but
it's like one step, because organic doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah,
so it's like one step up, you
it's
know.
A step further, I guess.
So it's like it's a well-balanced fish aquarium that takes care of itself because it's balanced. It's like the Star Trek simple analogy coming in. All right. I was just wondering.
Yeah, you're biodynamic.
Thanks, Phil. Go ahead.
So maybe tell us the story of how they found you.
Yeah. How'd you get poached?
How did I get here?
You were at an LCD Sound System concert, and then they saw you in the crowd and like, who's that?
Pulled you up on stage like Courtney Cox.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened. But the story I tell is so Randy Moon is one of the co-owners of the Four Horsemen, and he and I...
Any relationship to or relation to Keith Moon?
Not that I know of. And he and I turned out have a mutual friend in Australia, and this friend, Mike, connected me and Randy. This was last year, the middle of last year, and I happened to be in the States at that time. I was visiting my wife's family in Colorado, and we kind of hooked up, came over to New York for one night, met like all the partners, and then I ended up with a job 2 days later. Went back to Australia, we were in the throes of kind of closing things up with Garage East. We were on the market and we ended up selling this year, but so I kind of transitioned out of there and moved to New York in November. And yeah, and that's how they found me. And that's how I ended up here.
That's a long way to go.
That's not as exciting as the story you were telling, Phil.
When did you move here?
November last year.
So you were part of the process of... I mean, if it's November, they probably already had things moving along in the restaurant.
Things were moving. So there was the basically construction period and like, yeah, just all the setting up, getting to know each other, finding staff and yeah. I was involved, pretty much from the very beginning.
Yeah. And so you're the GM and do you also it sounds like you know a lot about wine. Are you responsible for the wine program?
Yeah, I take care of the wine program with one of the other owners. We do that together and I don't really know that much about wine.
Yes, you do.
I just drink a lot.
Well, you know, I was
that makes you an expert by proxy.
Yeah, right. People are like, how do you know about wine? I'm like, you just drink it.
Well, that's probably I would say twice a year I have friends or customers that approach me. And they're like, oh, I'm going to start my own restaurant and bar. And then I'm just like, please don't do this.
Because
people think like, I've eaten food and drank things since I was born. So that makes me an expert about this thing. And so like, yeah. So I'm not buying that you're a wine expert because you drink wine, first of all. But what I was going to say is that what I really like about your menu is it's a pretty large wine menu.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really like about it is it's a perfect balance between a few things that I find important in wine lists, which is, first of all, I hate when I look at a big wine list and then the cheapest bottle is $100.
Yeah.
I hate that. I also hate if I see a big wine list, and then I know every single wine on it.
Yeah.
And then I also hate a wine list where I don't know one of them.
Yeah.
So it's this, it's like with the price and the types of wine that you have and the varieties, there's a couple of things I've never heard of. There's a couple of brands I've never heard of, but then there's just a lot that I have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And then the price is like, you know, I think your low bottle is like, I think like $28 or $30, and then it goes up to the multi-hundreds. And I like that too, because, you know, it appeals to everyone.
I think, yeah, exactly that. Like, it's quite accessible and, We want to share these wines. We love these wines, and you know, part of it is just sharing and like letting customers experience things, like not making anything unattainable.
Mm-hmm.
And that also comes through in the service as well. Like, all the staff are really on board with all that. They love talking about the wines, and you know, we try and drink as much as possible
so we can talk about the wines. Training a staff. You know, on an extensive wine list, mm-hmm. I've been in, and I have to say, I had, you know, an amazing experience every time I've been in, and have had some like really great conversations with the staffs about the wine.
Yeah.
Tried wine I would have never had before. Mm-hmm. They were excited about.
Yeah,
it just seems daunting though to, you know, bring people to that level. Although I guess in New York you probably are working with some experience.
Yeah,
they actually go to AA meetings and then they sit there anonymously and then they find that one person that like, yeah, I was drinking like 12 bottles of wine a day for the last 10 years, and then they're like, that's our way. Later.
Pretty much.
That's not a bad idea, actually. Sorry.
Yeah, but I mean, we try and do regular tastings like every couple of weeks, and obviously everything that is by the glass is always available for, you know, we let customers try things. Like, it's one thing to try and explain a wine and the flavor profile of a wine, but the only way you really know is to taste it.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot of that, and, you know, we change the glass selection often, so we get to try a lot of different things in that way as well. And, you know, we have a lot of regulars that come back and they always want to try something new. So it keeps us excited, keeps the customers excited. And
nice.
Yeah.
Great.
And then,
I was just going to say, let's take a quick break.
Great.
And then we'll be back to talk more natural wines.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. And you know, I remember my very first show, December 2009. Ooh, it was a cold winter. And my first guest was William Grimes from the New York Times. Now, the one specific I had to tell him was wear a hat, gloves, and a warm coat, because our studio had no heat. We had no heat in the winter. We had no air conditioning in the summertime. It was rough going, but we were a startup, and we had a good show, regardless of the fact that we could see our breath. So today, we still have hurdles to climb over, and the only way we can get there is with your help. So if you would please consider being a member and press that little beating heart button in the upper right-hand corner to donate. It's going to help us have heat and electricity and air conditioning and really good sound with really great guests. Thanks for listening.
Hey And we're back with the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We are in studio with Katrina Birchmeyer from The Four Horsemen. And we were just chatting about natural wine and wine list. Phil, I never realized you had so many feelings about wine lists.
Oh, man.
I learned something today.
Yeah, man. I got into, for you to know, Katrina, I got into sake about 7 years ago. And I love sake, like, more than anything else.
Me too.
But before that, I was really immersed in the wine world. My history is I worked in a lot of fine dining restaurants. So there was one restaurant in particular that I worked at in Palm Beach, and they hired, like, you know, a month before the season started, and to work there, you know, if you worked there last year, you can work there again. But if you were new, you had to take like a 4-day wine class, and it was 4 hours a day with their sommelier. Like, it was pretty intense.
That's cool.
So I got to see some neat wines along the way.
Nice.
Yeah.
That is a nice perk of the service industry in general. It's like you do get exposure and you know, great food, great wine.
But I love restaurants and I love food and wine and all that stuff. But any time that I had to learn a wine list, I would get excited about it because I would I'd be like, it's like new knowledge, and you know, there's so many subtle nuances between each thing that I wanted to try them all. So
yeah.
Katrina, do you have any favorites on the wine list that you're super excited about?
Favorites, so many.
What do you gravitate towards?
Well,
wine.
Yeah.
Some favorites at the moment. So we have this kind of crazy orange sparkling wine, which is called Veg, I think, VEJ. It's from Italy. And so orange wine, this is another funny thing that we talk about orange wine, which is basically skin contact white wine. So it's funny because everyone's like, well, orange wine isn't an official term. And I'm like, well, if orange wine is an official term, then red wine is an official term, because basically it's just describing the color. But anyway, the context of orange wine is that it's white wines fermented on skins. The wines pick up a lot of different characters from that.
Isn't that like rosé? Isn't rosé just fermented on skins, or is it just...
It's basically like white wine made like a red wine. So rosé is very short skin contact of red grape varieties. And red wine is long skin contact of red grape varieties. And then orange wine is long skin contact of white grape varieties.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we have this crazy orange sparkling wine, which is extremely interesting and just like so aromatic, and then it's like really dry and just like one of the most crazy things you'll have. It's just so kind of captivating, like, that someone made a wine like that. I like that sort of interest in a wine, like, really, someone made that. Like, I think that's really interesting. So that's a fun wine. We also have, like, there's one of my favorite producers. His name's Axel Prüfer, and his domain name is Le Temple de Cerise. And he makes, like, really light, fun red wines from the Languedoc. And we have one on at the moment called the Foudroy, which we're pouring by the glass. And so that's my staff drink every night. That's the fun thing about curating the wine by the glass list. You're like, yeah. Put on the things you want to drink at the end of the night.
Yeah.
So that's some fun stuff.
Or you can make it, you know, like a moment's decision of like, I really think that this Chateau Margaux should be by the glass.
Right.
So that means I should open this and try it.
Totally.
Oh no, we're not going to do this by the
glass.
No,
good.
I should just finish the whole bottle.
Totally.
What are the considerations when you're choosing a wine, you know, to put on the list by the glass?
Well, there's a few. Obviously price is one. To be, you know, relatively affordable by the glass, having a number of different flavor profiles, and having some that will pique interest, some that will kind of make people turn in disgust, and some that will just be like good, you know, easy drinking wines if people don't want to think too much about things. So, yeah, we change things like almost every week. We try and have something new. Yeah, I guess that's the main consideration. And then, fun new stuff that maybe we get a small allocation of that we want to share as well.
I kind of noticed this. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's mostly French, and then there's some Italian, Spanish, and United States.
Yeah.
But then I didn't really see much of, like, you know,
the rest of the world.
Yeah, like Hungarian or Chilean or Canadian ice wine. No.
Yeah. I mean, the aim is to build some of those other sections into the wine list as well. But yeah, I guess our palate is a lot, you know, more francophile. I want to build the Italian section, but yeah, there's a lot of wine out in the world that would be great to have on the list, but you know, so it's like, do we just kind of keep it this small focus, and then, you know, slowly we'll expand and build on some of those other sections. Like, I don't know that much about Spanish wine, so I want to get into that and try and grow that.
Love
as well.
Spanish wine. Mm. I think a lot. Well, for the past year, we've been seeing in a lot of restaurants that I've been to, at least, is a lot of Hungarian. And
yeah.
And then also, I mean, especially like Blanca and Roberta's, really the Sardinian. Sardinian
Wine.
There's a lot of good stuff coming out of Sardinia.
Croatian wine too.
Yeah.
Slavic wine.
Yeah.
Are there more natural wine producers in France, or is, like, a disproportionate to the rest of the world? Is that why?
I think there's a lot, and I think that's what we have access to in this country a lot more so than some of the others. I mean, Italy as well is growing, but yeah, I think a lot of it is, yeah, having the access to that. I've become kind of interested in Georgian wine, so we've got like
Atlanta, Georgia, peach later.
The Not Republic Georgia. Of Georgia. No. So
chicken,
yeah,
chicken and waffles vineyard.
That's going to be the new section on the wine list. Yeah, so we've got some interesting stuff brought in from Georgia. Some, you know, things that I've never seen before. So, like, a lot of their stuff is, you know, a lot of the stuff that we see is orange wines. That's what they call white wine. That's how they've always made white wine on skins.
Yeah.
But yeah, some interesting reds from Georgia as well. So that's been super fun to experience that. I haven't seen a lot of that stuff back in Australia. So
the Four Horsemen was actually the first time I ever tried orange wine, to my recollection.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I just never had it. I felt like kind of a dummy. I was like, orange wine? They put orange slices in it?
First time.
The first orange wine I ever had was a vineyard called Boone's Farm, and they have a wine called Orange Jubilee.
Wow.
Yes, and there's
Atlanta, Georgia.
No, and then there was this great place called the Haitian Station, and it was in West Palm Beach, Florida, and they would sell us marijuana and cheap wine.
Boone.
at like 16 years old. Yeah, so yeah, check it out. But Boone's Farm Orange Jubilee. It's the best one out of all of them.
Can we get a link to that in this week's episode? Yeah. Thanks.
Boone's Goon. Do you use that word for wine, goon? Maybe that's an Australian thing. It's like bad, bad wine. Call it goon.
Can we hear it in using a sentence?
Yeah.
Boone's goon.
Boone's goon.
I mean,
but does it always follow goon or boon?
So no. So I mean, it's just like
this wine is real goon, man.
No, I don't know. It's like the wine is the goon. Like, it's like, I don't know. It's like what 16-year-olds drink.
Oh, that would 100% be Boone's. there's. Mad Dog 2020, Boone's Farm.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the food and the chef. Do you have any input, since you're the GM? And are you a partner there as well, I guess?
No.
Okay.
Just the GM.
Just the GM. But as far as the food, do you have, since you're such an integral part of the wine list, do you actually have some any input on the food?
I mean, I definitely get to try the dishes. I always like to give my feedback, but the chefs have...
I like to give my feedback, too.
The chefs have a really good understanding. Like, Nick Cotola, the chef, he also loves natural wine, and so he's got a really good understanding of the kind of flavors that work with the wine, and he will, you know, he will talk about, okay, is, you know, such and such flavor too strong for the wines, and we always try and work towards, you know, wine-friendly food, because we've got food-friendly wine. So I have a little bit of input, but they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So you guys have a great food menu.
Yeah, the food menu is great, too. It actually kind of is also the same with the wine list. It's just very approachable.
Yeah.
Price point's great.
And also, too, I don't know who's responsible for the wording on the menu, but I'm very, very picky about at Momo or any of my restaurants, or when I go to, like, you know, sometimes people put like one or two words, and then other times people put zero words, and sometimes they put like 30
a
words.
Paragraph.
But I just love, I love if you just say, okay, this is the dish, mm-hmm. and then here's a couple of the highlighted ingredients, yep. and you don't have to go into like, you know,
yep.
that you, I don't know, soaked the freaking turkey broth for 10 days. I don't care. Yeah. Like, you know, it's just the way that you worded the menu is so yeah. simple and elegant. I really yeah. appreciate that.
No, that's definitely something that, you know, the owners were very adamant about, like, making it sound, I guess, a little bit more simple, and then, like, there being a surprise on the plate because mm-hmm. Undersell and over deliver in a way.
Did we not put live eel on the description? There? Oh, I'm so sorry. Surprise.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, we forgot the live bit.
Yeah, yeah.
It's catch your own eel, slaughter it, and eat it 5 hours later when it stopped moving. Yeah.
And so it looks too also that you guys are doing kind of like farm to table. Like with a lot of the ingredients, like yeah. kind of heirloom ingredients?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the chefs go to the markets, the green market weekly, and always looking for interesting things. We've got, you know, building connections with farmers so that we can have heirloom varieties, interesting ingredients, and, you know, tasty ingredients.
I think that's the thing I like most about the menu is that it is, you know, farm mm-hmm. driven, mm-hmm. but they're not punching you in the face that's to tell right. you it's from the farm.
That's right.
Because all food comes from a farm. All food in one way is yep. farm to table.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Farm to table.
What does that mean?
Do you guys use heritage? Out of curiosity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
do.
I don't
we
know.
Use heritage pork.
If
but we should get some goat.
Yeah, you guys.
We need goat.
I mean, goat-tober.
Yeah. Goat-tober.
Goat-tober.
I will happily deliver you guys some goat. I'll bring it over myself.
All right.
Sit down for a glass of wine.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's nice. It's I would say it's really a veg-forward kind of menu, though, which is
yeah.
a nice treat, yep. especially for me. I eat so much meat.
You eat a lot of meat.
All the
like
time.
Like a lot of goat currently.
I've been eating so much goat lately.
I'm sorry I don't know more about Nick because I should have done more of my research.
That's
but
okay.
It seems that he has a lot of Spanish influence as well.
Yeah, I think they do draw a lot of influence from around the world, but
the world.
Spanish, Mediterranean, mm-hmm. Italian. I mean, he cooked in Piedmont for some time as well, and his background, like Franny's and Gladys in its former...
Oh, yeah, Franny yeah. came from Franny's.
Yeah.
Yeah,
really.
So, yeah.
Franny's is a great spot.
Yeah.
Franny's is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw the hake on there, and that's, I always, mm-hmm. like, I never remember about hake. It's such a Spanish fish.
Yeah.
Hake?
I know.
Really?
I'm not a, you know, I did not grow up eating a lot of fish, so it's just something that I'm
in
incredibly.
South Florida.
Yeah, in South Florida.
You I'm hate gator.
No, yeah. I ate gator. I had a lot of frog's legs. Yeah. Those are super easy and delicious. No, my family is all from New York, you know, Bay Ridge, Italian background. Mm. It's just not, you know, shellfish, clams, mussels. Yeah,
do you know hake? Have you ever had
I've
hake?
Never.
Yeah, it's a super Spanish fish. It's but the weird thing is, I think you can get hake in the Northeast, but you just don't really see it on menus. It's actually one time I actually used to work at a Spanish tapas restaurant. It's one of the best things I've ever had. It was basically a paella, but they have like it's not even the cheeks. It's like this little mussel right under the jawline. It's just this little tenderloin thing, probably about an inch and a half long. But it's like $50 a pound, but you can just buy those just from the hake. And so you just buy it.
Like, it's like two per hake, right?
Yeah. It's like yeah, it's only, yeah, it's two per hake. So when you buy it, it's like $50 for a pound of it. And then, but that with paella is just amazing. I don't even know the name. Ask Nick for me. Yeah.
Oh,
he probably knows.
Yeah.
The
hake jaw.
Yeah. What's
hake
that
jaw?
What is that called? Yeah.
Hake throat.
The underjaw? Yeah.
The underjaw. Hake throat. Hake throat.
Mmm. Sounds delicious.
Have you spent much time over in France or Spain? Have you gone to any vineyards?
I've spent a little bit of time in France, mainly in Paris, though, so I haven't done a lot of vineyards. I've been a little bit to Loire Valley. I haven't done any vineyards in Spain, but I'd like to. I definitely would love to get out to more vineyards.
Mm.
Yeah.
Someday.
Do you know what my favorite white wine is? It's like a good Chateau Neuf de Pop white.
Yeah. Well, you don't really see that very often.
I know. It's also like $5 billion.
Yeah.
it's so
spend your life savings.
It's so
there.
Good, yeah.
Katrina, I just want to say thank you so much for coming out on a Sunday and sitting with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been
fun.
Yeah,
I'm so excited to come eat. I'm sorry you haven't been in yet. Yeah.
If come
you
guys, this afternoon.
If for anyone else who hasn't been to the Four Horsemen, you should check it out. It's in Williamsburg on Grand Street.
Yeah. 295 Grand.
295 Grand.
Yeah, we're open every night.
Are you open for brunch?
Every single night.
Not yet.
Cool, don't
I
do
mean,
it.
Thank God.
We are don't not do it. Don't do it. Trust me.
But yeah, 7 nights, 5:30, from 5:30 on the weeknights and from 3 p.m. on the weekends. So nice afternoon beverage in the front window.
Yeah.
Well, it's definitely worth checking out. If you go there, make sure to ask for Katrina. Tell her that you listen to her and she will... buy you a plate of hake throats.
Yeah. Yeah.
Promise.
Yes. And ask her to sample all the wines by the glass. She'll just give you a sample of every single one. Then you get out of there without
suicide
spending
style.
Any money.
No.
That's right. Yeah. Business is great.
Can I just try one more? I hate those people. Like, you know, I'm giving you a taste of this.
And then they order the first glass that they try.
Exactly.
If they order one.
Yeah.
No.
You know, I'm going to stick with water and do a nice tea, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, guys. Well, we will we'll see you next Sunday.
This program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.